Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppen.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today we delve into the mystery once again of ancient aliens with our special guest, Giorgio Tsoukalos. So, Giorgio, welcome to The Spirit Revolution.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be on the program.
And I have to say, you are our first guest who actually has a Facebook fan page for his hair.
I think you should have one too, Philip. Absolutely. I think you and I are the ones with the best hair on that show.
I absolutely agree. So, Giorgio, you and I go back for 15 years or so. We've kind of been hanging around the Ancient Astronaut Society conferences in the 1990s. And I think we've both seen how this subject has transformed itself to what it is right now, which is one of the most popular episodes of the History Channel. Give us a bit of background as to how the voyage of the ancient alien happened to Giorgio and as a subject.
Well, pretty much, I have to thank my grandmother for this, because growing up in Switzerland, I had the privilege of traveling around the world with my parents. And whenever we would come back from a visit to Greece or from a visit anywhere in the world, my grandma would say, okay, so you've been to all these museums, you've been to these different archaeological places. However, let me show you what alternative viewpoints there are about these different places. So she would tell me about Atlantis, she would tell me about ancient astronauts, and talk to me about ghosts and things like that. And plus, you know, at my house, this was sort of dinner table conversation where my mom especially kept on saying, and back in the day I never knew what she meant, but she kept on saying, you know, I really think that all of this that we have today, it's been here before, that this is just a repetition of history. And I never got what she meant, but today, you know, 20, 25 years later, I totally understand what she means. And, you know, even though my dad is a U.S. citizen and my grandfather and great-grandfather are all from Queens, New York, I did grow up in Switzerland, and Eric von Daniken is Swiss. So in my early teens, I started to attend his lectures, and I started to hang out with his friends. Then I became friends with him, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Ancient history.
Yes, absolutely. No, and you know, and then back in 1997, the former Ancient Astronaut Society that was founded in 1973 by Dr. Gene Phillips, he wanted to go into retirement because, you know, he was already retired, but not really, because he was running the Ancient Astronaut Society. So he says, you know, I've had enough. I just want, you know, have my life quietened down. And so, you know, they were going to continue the German version of the Ancient Astronaut Society, and they basically said, you know, we also need to have some type of a new society in the English-speaking world, so that, you know, this information is not kept from the public. And so I, you know, raised my hand and I said, here, how about me? And after a few months of deliberation, discussions, I was asked to do it. And what was I supposed to do? Say no? I grabbed the bull by its horns, and here we are.
And here we are. I mean, when you go back, say the 1970s, the 1990s, 2010, where we are right now, the climate has changed. People in the 1970s were both open to have Eric von Daniken go on radio and TV and present his point of view, but also the skeptics had their go at him and had free range in shooting him down. And you and I, we kind of entered this field specifically in the 1990s, where there was very much a big controversy. I remember Graham Hancock being viciously and violently attacked by the BBC for some of the stuff he was saying around fingerprints of the gods, which wasn't even going into the ancient alien subject. It was just tackling ancient civilizations and asking questions about them and whether they might have some kind of technology and whether they might be evidence of a previous civilization. So in 2010 and starting in 2009, all of a sudden, Ancient Aliens is the top-rated History Channel show where the skeptics don't have a say, where the evidence once again is presented the way it should be. How did that happen?
Well, thanks to the gods. That's how it happened. No, I mean, the way it happened is basically that I was invited to be on a program called Indiana Jones and the Ultimate Quest. And that documentary, two-hour documentary, came out a couple of days before the new Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Temple of, or Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, was released. And that documentary basically looked at the reality behind all the archaeological hunts that were described in the Indiana Jones, or illustrated in the Indiana Jones movies. And so for the third, for the fourth film, the movie was all about crystal skulls, but since they couldn't reveal everything about the movie 2 days before in this documentary, you know, the crystal skull portion was limited to only one act at the very, very end. However, they did make the point in that act that there is a possibility that these crystal skulls have some type of an extraterrestrial connection. And so, I mean, I don't believe in chance, I don't believe in coincidence, but I received a call from Lucasfilm, or actually Prometheus, but they were commissioned by Lucasfilm to make this documentary, because they, you know, wanted to have someone talk about the ancient astronaut theory. And so I went in, I did that, and then filmed it, they aired it, and then on June 4th of 2008, I received a phone call from Kevin Burns, and I was walking down 47th Street in New York City, and I remember it like it was yesterday, and he says, "Hi, this is Kevin Burns," and at the time I had never met him before, so because he's the main executive at Prometheus and the owner of that company. He's like, "Yeah, you know, you might know me. I'm Kevin, the guy from so-and-so Indiana Jones Ultimate Quest." I'm like, "Yeah, I've heard of you. I've never met him." And he says to me, he asks me, "Are you familiar with Chariots of the Gods?" I'm like, "Of course I am." And he's like, "Well, you know, I think there's this guy. His name is Eric von Daniken, who wrote that book. Are you familiar with him as well?" I said, "Kevin, not only am I familiar with him, I publish a magazine together with him." He's like, "Oh, so he's still alive?" I'm like, "Yes, he is." He's like, "Well, here's the idea. I would like you to come in next week to the office, and the History Channel would like to do a two-hour documentary about Ancient Aliens and Chariots of the Gods." Because by now, in 2009, it had been almost 40 years since the first publication of Chariots of the Gods. And so the following week, I went to the office, and they wanted to, you know, they presented the idea to me, and I said, "That's very nice, but Eric will not participate." And they said, Why not?" I'm like, "Because, you know, we've been burnt, especially Eric, over the decades. You know, put a knife in our backs and turn it and stuff like this." And then, you know, he's like, no, I want this to be a love letter to the ancient alien theory." And I was like, "Okay, well, that's really interesting, yada, yada, yada." And to make a long story short, Eric was not going to participate until they made me consulting producer, which meant that there was some type of trust going on. And also, not only that, but I truly believed that Kevin Burns, because he then also told me that he's interested in David versus Goliath story, and so that the ancient alien theory is David and Goliath is, you know, the mainstream. And they pulled it off. Now, yes, they're in the first pilot, as we call it today, Chariots, Gods, and Beyond, as it is called today, did have skeptics in it and debunkers. But at one point, when one of the first drafts was submitted to the History Channel, the History Channel said, "Take out more debunkers, because this is cool stuff. Let's see what they have to say." And then season one came, and there were even less debunkers. And now we're in season two, and there's hardly any. debunkers. And it is such a refreshing breath of air, a breath of fresh air, that that this is happening right now. Because, you know, if you look at the ancient alien theory, all we do is we raise questions, and if these questions are uncomfortable, so be it.
Well, we all live in this world of esoteric and alternative science and history. And so for me, it has been extremely exciting to watch this show evolve into something where there really is this extraordinary freedom to express these theories, and where the debunkers don't get the last word, as they always have in the past. So to your point, it is an it's a wonderful, fresh thing to see. And, you know, bravo to Kevin Burns and Prometheus and to you for making this happen. But aren't you also seeing that there's the reward for this is audience? I mean, the audience is building. This is one of the highest rated shows, if not the highest rated show on the History Channel. So clearly you are reaching a market that is hungry for this. And what does that tell us about the way people's minds, thoughts are evolving? And I think this is kind of back to what Philip's question was earlier, which is that we have watched an interesting pattern from the late 60s to now in terms of acceptance, skepticism, and now I think we're moving back into a place of at least open-mindedness and really healthy curiosity. Do you agree, and where do you think this is going?
Absolutely. What I've noticed is that, you know, it now happens, and it's absolutely delightful. Sometimes I get recognized at bars or restaurants or on the street and stuff. And it's genuinely delightful. It's really wonderful. Hey, you're the guy, the crazy hair guy from Ancient Aliens and stuff like this. But all of the recognitions that I get from people on the streets is young people. Young people, and by that I mean like teenagers and people and you know, kids in their 20s and early 30s and stuff like that. So that to me is very reassuring, because I have yet to meet someone who is in that young of an age group who says that stuff that you do is crazy, because it's really not. Yes, to the outside world, this whole ancient astronaut theory is completely bizarre, completely speculative, completely, yes, nutty. But the deeper you look at it, if you take the time to look at it, it does have its valid points. And look, if there is a piece of evidence that no longer is valid, I'll be the first one to say, out, this piece has to be removed. And that doesn't mean that the theory itself gets weaker. Quite on the contrary, it gets stronger, because you eliminate all the false pieces of evidence. And so the fact that there is this, like you said, this craving out there is very reassuring, because there are mysteries that have so far remained unsolved. And anyone who argues against that doesn't know what they're talking about.
Well, there are clearly so many unanswered questions, and that is what makes all of this so interesting and so exciting, is that no one can deny that. No one can deny that there are unanswered questions and there are incredibly unexplained things out there that we just can't reason. We cannot get our 21st century reasoning brain around certain mysteries of life on Earth. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, of all the things that you cover, all these different areas of research, what is the one thing that for you is the real evidence? What is the one thing that you look at and you say, when I see this, I know that this theory of ancient astronauts is real?
Two words, Puma Punku. And, you know, this is probably the 10,000th time that I've talked about Puma Punku, and it never, ever gets old. Because that place, it absolutely defies logic. Puma Punku is a place in the Andean Highlands on the border between Peru and Bolivia, right next to Lake Titicaca, which is the highest navigable lake in the world. And there, you know, there are actually two sites. One site is world famous, and every day dozens of tourists arrive there with their cameras in buses. And it's this site called Tiwanaku. Tiwanaku is Incan / pre-Incan. There's absolutely no question about that. It's beautiful. It's got, you know, some monoliths there, some beautiful carvings of heads, beautiful carvings of glyphs and flowers and embellishments, you know, very ritualistic type, worship type of stuff and carvings. But only 150 yards away from this Tiwanaku site, there is another site called Pumapunku. And at Pumapunku, absolutely nothing makes sense because, number one, the site is completely anonymous. Not a single glyph has been found. Number two, the blocks of stone that have been used there or that can be found there are upwards of 60 to 80 tons, metric tons. And the precision with which these stone blocks were cut, we would have difficulties replicating that today. Because the stone that's used there is granite, hard igneous rock, so diorite, andesite, all those different things. And you see, we have these, for example, one perfect groove that has holes every 2 inches that go 3 inches into that granite block. It's a little monolith. And, you know, archaeology tells us that this was done with chicken bones and with string. And, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, I am not, let me repeat this, I am not denying that our ancestors knew how to cut stone. Of course they knew how to cut stone. They knew how to cut limestone. They knew how to, cut porous stone, soft rock, no problem. And they had the tools for this. But you know what? I don't care about those things. I mean, God bless them that they were able to cut this stuff. I'm interested in the stuff that we see at Pumapunku, for example, where a real-life stonemason by the name of Roger Hopkins, who has a stone quarry where he works in Palm Springs, I showed him pictures of blocks that have been found at Pumapunku, and I said, "Okay, Roger, what do you say? Could you replicate this with our modern technology?" And he said, "Not for any given amount of money would I ever volunteer to even attempt to replicate this." And while he was saying this, there was smoke coming out of his ears. All right? So now, who am I going to listen to? Am I going to listen to a real-life stonemason who cuts stone every day with diamond-tipped tools, or am I going to listen to the professor? Look, professors are doing great. They're doing a wonderful job, but sometimes professors, despite the evidence that's staring them in the face, look the other way. And that, to me, is not very professorial. That, to me, is not very academic. It is not science. It isn't. Because, like I said, I know and I'm perfectly aware that our ancestors knew how to cut stone, you know, soft stone and, you know, medium-grade stones, but not granite, where today we are using diamond-tipped stones or high-water pressure drills in order to recreate some of these things. I mean, it's beyond. And then, for example, in Baalbek, Lebanon, there is a monolith called the Stone of the Pregnant Woman, which is, you know, 1,400 tons, and estimates 1,400 tons, that's just, it's just lying there. It's as if they were working, and then they just disappeared. And right next to that, there is a Roman temple, as they call it today, called Heliopolis, where, yes, obviously the Romans built on top of that particular construction. But the base of that construction has stones that are as big as railway cars, weighing as much as 2,000 to 2,500 tons. Now, our cranes today, we're leveling out at around 2,000, 2,500 tons. So, you know, and even if our cranes today would level out at 3,000 tons, that's 2010. We're talking prehistory here. And they were able to do this with chicken bones and with string. Forget it.
Well, I know that there was a tsunami, I believe it was in 2006, but it was 4 or 5 years ago, that took down some of the Easter Island icons, some of the giant statues at Easter Island. And to this day, even with modern equipment and computer technology, they can't restore them. They cannot get these enormous stones back upright. They can't do it. And they don't know how it happened. And that to me is, you know, when I hear things like that, that really grabs my imagination and my mind and my spirit and my heart and says, what does this mean? What does this mean when in the 21st century we can't fix it?
Well, and you know, and the crazy thing, I'm so glad that you bring up Easter Island, because you see, again, you know, all the Easter Island statues were built or were carved by human beings. There's absolutely none of these things, except maybe for Puma Punku, was actually built by extraterrestrials. The pyramids were not built by aliens. I mean, that's complete nonsense, because the ancient texts are saying that the pyramids were built by the ancient Egyptians with the help of the guardians of the sky. Who were the guardians of the sky? Extraterrestrials, in our opinion, of course. And so on Easter Island, you see, still today, there are, well, first of all, you know, when Thor Heyerdahl tried to replicate and show how, you know, these Easter Island statues can be very easily transported on the island and very easily erected, what nobody tells you in all of these wonderful misleading documentaries is the fact that the trial Easter Island statue that they used was maybe, you know, 5 feet tall. Where the real Easter Island statues, moais, are, what, 30 feet tall? Because what you see is not the entire statue. They go deep into the ground. Two-thirds of the statue is in the ground. I mean, they're massive statues. And then you have these amazing hats that are made of coral that are then hoisted on top of those statues as well, red coral sometimes, and then they have the eyes that they put in with white and black stones, and so, you know, so Thor Heyerdahl, quote unquote, said he proved how it's done, but he didn't. I'm sorry. Yes, wonderful work. He's a great gentleman. May he rest in peace. But it is not proving how it was done. Now, the other thing that's very interesting is that still today, you can go to the quarry of where many of these Easter Islands were statues were, you know, cut out of the side of the rock, and there are two Easter Island heads, massive ones, that are still in situ. They're like still there inside the rock, but you know, it's as if they were working on it, and then something happened, and poof, they once again disappeared.
Again.
Now, archaeology says that all of these Easter Island statues were cut out or carved out by essentially using hand axes, stoned hand axes, and picking away at that statue. Well, if you ask the local islanders, they've been picking away at that thing since time immemorial, and it has not changed. So what the heck does that tell you? Well, according to their legends, all this stuff happened with this magical power called mana. And mana was given to them by the bird people. Bird people, hello, can you be more obvious what bird people are? That they somehow were able to levitate these stones. Because the other idea is also, you know, mainstream archaeology suggests this was all done. The transportation was done with wooden rollers.
The pulley system, like the pyramids, right? Like what they say, they try to make us believe that the pyramids were built, you know, on this pulley system with rollers and slaves. And we know absolutely now that that's impossible.
Yes. Not only is it impossible, but the thing is that Easter Island is a very windy, windy island. So they never had trees on there that have massive tree trunks that could be used as wooden rollers. You know, I come from the Greek islands, so I know that on those islands, yes, there are trees in sheltered places, but for the most part, they're just like little shrubbery trees, you know, with very thin trunks and things like this, and, you know, very, very windy trunks and just bizarre-looking, quote-unquote, trees. And you cannot use those things for wooden rollers. You can't. And so when we were at the stone quarry in Palm Springs with Roger Hopkins, he actually had some monoliths standing on wooden rollers. And guess what? Those monoliths were about 2 tons, and those wooden rollers were crushed. And we're talking about stones that are 1,000 tons, and they also use wooden rollers there. Forget it. It's complete nonsense.
So we've been talking about the standoff, if you want, over the years between the evidence which archaeologists uncover but then fail to potentially interpret correctly. One of the bones of contentions I have with archaeology stroke historians is how they endorse Manetho's king list as far as dynastic Egypt goes, but Manetho in his king list makes it very specific that just before you have a list of demigods who ruled for, I've forgotten, the followers of Horus for about, I think, 6,000 years, roughly the same period for a few demigods, and then before that, the gods ruled, Ra, Osiris, all of the names of these people. In law, in any court, there's such a thing as, like, the indivisibility of evidence. You either take the evidence and you endorse it or you attack it, but you can't chop it. And this is something which I feel is happening in Pumapunku, it's happening in Tiwanaku, it's happening in Egypt, every time archaeology does it. But specifically they do it with Manetho as well. And so we have a 300 BC Egyptian high priest who says, according to the ancient Egyptians, the gods walked Egypt. When you go to places like the Hopi Reservation in Arizona, they will tell you that the people who dress up as Kachinas with masks today are actually impersonating a previous era where the gods at these festivals walked amongst themselves. So, two continents, two examples, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these examples of a time when the gods walked amongst us. So, where does that go within an ancient alien context? Do you feel that all of these places had a deity? Is this deity an extraterrestrial presence? Or are some of them more like, you know, memories of, how should I put this, one place somewhere else where the gods were and then were dispersed across the world?
Yeah, I mean, the classic ancient astronaut theory, which I represent along with you and with Eric von Daniken and Childress and Zechariah Sitchin, who unfortunately passed away only a few weeks ago, essentially suggests that every ancient culture has been visited by flesh and blood extraterrestrials, because the debunkers are always making the case, well, you know, you guys are just saying people in Africa and in South America were dumb and they're the ones who were visited, and, you know, Europeans or quote-unquote white people were never visited. And that is such a horrible accusation, because it's simply untrue, because even in Scandinavian countries, in Greece, in Italy, all over the place, in France, we have stories of the Shining Ones, for example, in Britain, descending from the sky on flying, glowing shields, and all those different myths suggesting that extraterrestrials have visited Earth in a remote past on all different continents. Also in China, I mean, if you look at the stories of, you know, the dragon kings that descended from the sky in these fiery dragons, come on, let's be honest. Did dragons, as a biological creature, did they really exist? Of course not. It was a misunderstood space vehicle or something like this, with the flames coming out or something, that our ancestors, while highly intelligent, they misinterpreted that stuff as being magical or living in nature, which it never was. It was just nuts and bolts technology that went right over their head. And what you were saying, you know, before, that you can't, you know, chop up evidence, is so right, because what happens today in archaeology is, let's say you have a text that is 3 paragraphs long. And in the first paragraph, it says that, you know, these people here are gathered because they're waiting the arrival of this one deity that has arrived every 52 years and, you know, gave them a moral code, taught them about various academic disciplines, this and that. Now, in the second paragraph, it says that this deity, lo and behold, arrives out from the sky, descends in a flying shield, spends 4 days amongst those humans, teaches them, interacts with them, and then departs again in his flying shield, or flying furnace, or flying chariot, or what have you. The third paragraph says that now the people are still gathered, but they're now talking amongst themselves to try to make sense out of this amazing divine visit that just occurred. What does archaeology do? They will accept paragraph 1 and 3 and toss out paragraph 2, saying that there's no way that that could have happened because it describes otherworldly stuff. Now, I have a very concise and very serious question to the archaeologists. Who is insulting whom here? Is it really the ancient alien theorists who at least have the willingness to look at the second paragraph and try to interpret it, you know, from a modern day's perspective, what was described here? And yes, in the ancient alien perspective, it had to do with flesh and blood, extraterrestrials, and nuts and bolts spaceships. But the scientists don't even do that. They just throw it out the window with the bathwater. And that is an insult in the face of our ancestors.
Absolutely. Well, and we, Philip and I, have certainly found this in our own work as well. The unexplained is just eradicated. Rather than dealt with, rather than considered, if we can't explain it from science, academia merely discards it. Or invent something that we would never get away with, you know, says, oh, well, we're just going to attribute it to, you know, X, Y, or Z, and put some really nonsensical explanation, if they even bother to examine it at all. And as you said, if this is really science, if this is really in the interest of truly understanding the nature of things, we have an obligation to look at every single aspect. We have an obligation to read all those paragraphs and not just cut and paste, but look at how they all come together. And what I'm seeing in the 21st century that I'm excited about is in whether it's the ancient alien theories, whether it's alternative history, whether it's biblical history, all these things that are coming to light now, we're seeing that people, the general public, for the first time, I think, really, in human history, the general public is now opening their minds and saying, you know what, we're no longer going to accept the academic point of view. We're no longer going to accept exactly what science says as the only thing out there. We're going to start listening here. And like you, I'm having the same response from teenagers. I get the most amazing mail from teenagers who about all of these things. They write to me about what you're doing, about what Philip's doing. They write to me about what I'm doing. You know, I have, there's one amazing 16-year-old who writes to me, and she gets in trouble in her history class now because she is constantly saying to her teacher, but wait a minute, you know, what about this and what about that? And her teacher is still saying, well, those are conspiracy theories. We're dealing with facts. And these kids are saying, but what are facts? And where are these facts coming from? And aren't the facts things that we're not dealing with? So it's so exciting to me that we are, you know, in this wave of hopefully inspiring this younger generation to stand up and say, we are going to ask all of these questions and no one's going to stop us.
No, I think that that's, I'm just listening to myself here right now. Wonderful, Kathleen. Because look, here's the thing that, look, it seems like today science is almost stagnant. But science should be something that's a continuous flow of progress. Because the moment that science stands still, well, that's no longer science. And we've experienced these periods throughout history. In fact, look, if you go ahead and find yourself a textbook from, let's say, 1821, okay, and that textbook was used at some type of a university. Let's say it was used at Yale or at Oxford or something, a very high class, top university even back then. And look at that textbook. Let's say it's a medical textbook. 99%, or well, not 99, but maybe 90% of that stuff that's written in there is completely obsolete today. But at the time, that was cutting-edge knowledge. Otherwise, it would have never been put inside a textbook. And my prediction is that if you fast-forward yourself 100 years into the future and bring with you a textbook from today, 2010, and you're in 2110, and you look at textbooks from that future time, I think only 30 to 40% of the knowledge that we have today will still be valid 100 years from now. But I'm also convinced that in 100 years, if there's one theory that does survive and will get proven right, is the ancient astronaut theory.
So do you think that, okay, here we are in the 21st century, and shows like Ancient Aliens are getting, you know, fantastic responses, huge audiences. We have shows like The Event, which deals with aliens among us, right, who look just like us. Fascinating concept. All of a sudden, there are so many more reports of unidentified flying objects. There's so much information in the news now. You see it all the time. It's in Mongolia. They're shutting down airports because they can't identify what's in the skies. We had a couple of days ago, something happened off the coast of California. No one can explain it. The military doesn't know what it is. Nobody is able to explain it. So, a couple of questions here about that. Do you think that we are now experiencing this because we're more open to it? Is it because we're in the technological age of the internet and everything else that more people are talking about it and it's harder to cover up? Or do you think that there's really something happening here that is opening us up to a whole new world?
You know, that is really, you've opened up a treasure trove with that question, because one of the most frequent questions I get asked by young people, old people, doesn't matter by whom, people who are new to the subject, that I have been studying this for 20 years, 30, 40, 50 years, they always ask me one single question, that is, Giorgio, when do you think disclosure will happen? I'm like, what are you talking about? Look around you. Disclosure is happening right now. Now, it's happening this second with TV shows like you mentioned, The Event, and then the movie Skyline opens in theaters, which is all about aliens and, you know, people being sucked up into the air, almost rapture-like, you see. Now, if and when or whatever the rapture might happen, that is, you know, it could be an extraterrestrial event. Who knows? I mean, personally, I think the rapture is nonsense, sorry, but, you know, it's the whole idea that, you know, extraterrestrial life in Indiana Jones movies where they described ancient aliens, or Disney movies that talk about, you know, extraterrestrials as well. I mean, all that stuff is conditioning. And here in the States, we, you know, Hollywood has taken over that role, where in other countries, you know, governments are releasing the UFO reports and things like this. Here, this whole process, you know, has taken on a different form, that Hollywood is part of this. And I think it's wonderful because, look, 10 years ago, if somebody would have asked me, what do you think will happen if a UFO, there would be a mass sighting today seen by the entire planet on CNN? What would happen? 10 years ago, I would have told you that there would be mass panic. Today, I'm no longer sure about that. It'll be mass panic amongst the fundamentalist churchgoers, the fundamentalist religionists that are, you know, boxed in within their own minds. But in general, I think it'll be cool because, you know, first of all, I think that this whole fear-mongering culture that exists today, that you know, maintains that if aliens come here, they will destroy us and eat us, just like, you know, the movie Skyline will be all about. Now, let me tell you, the movie Skyline, I'm sorry, is entertainment, and it's wonderful entertainment. But in reality, if extraterrestrials would want to destroy or annihilate us, it would have already happened a long-ass time ago. And so, you know, I'm sorry, it's just nonsense, because But I'm also not suggesting that everything is hunky-dory with those extraterrestrials, because just like there's good and evil on planet Earth, there's good and evil out there on just a much bigger scale. But there is a type of intergalactic federation or intergalactic club out there that we sooner or later will belong to, but to belong to that, it's not a right, it's a privilege. And I don't think that will happen until we've cleaned up our own house, because right now we're not doing that great. And yes, you always look at the glass as being half full instead of half empty, but at the same time, you know, we've been given all the tools that we need for everything are within our hearts, but not many people utilize them. And therein lies a bit of a problem.
Okay, so this leads me to a question that I'm dying to ask you. So based on this idea of there being some kind of an intergalactic academy or federation or something, do you believe then that our ancestors, whether it was the Egyptians or the Incans or whoever is interacting with the Sky People, do you believe that they were a part of that? Do you believe that they were somehow actively involved, really, and had an understanding of sorts of this idea of a larger galactic community?
I am not sure about that. All I know, or all I'm sure about, is that these races and species of this intergalactic academy, which I like very much, that's your term, did visit Earth in the remote past on multiple occasions and interacted with human beings. Now, whether or not they were told, our ancestors were told, that there's an entire club out there, that I don't know. But our ancestors did have interact with those extraterrestrials that, you know, who came from different parts of the galaxy. And see, the other question that I get asked a lot is also not only that I get asked a lot, but you just, you know, watch the TV or read your news on the internet. The question is always, you know, if extraterrestrial life exists, what do they look like? And there are really scientists out there who say that if they exist, they would look vastly, vastly different than us. And I'm like, who gave you your doctorate? Who gave you your doctorate? Because every architect will tell you form follows function. So to suggest that extraterrestrials, you know, are just, a leaf that's walking around on its stem, or that it's like a blob, it's complete nonsense, because according to the ancient texts, we became human because of a direct manipulation of our DNA in the remote past by extraterrestrials, that we are essentially the product of their genetic engineering. And so the question shouldn't be, what do the extraterrestrials look like? But the question really is, do we look like the extraterrestrials? And in my opinion, the answer is yes, because we are half alien and half human. See, the ultimate proof will not be found in a pyramid. The ultimate proof will not be found in a crashed UFO, and it will certainly not be found in a ray gun. But it will be found in our DNA. Because right now, in order to clone a human being, you only need 95% of the genetic material. 5% of genetic material to clone a human being. The other 95%, geneticists are referring to that, that is genetic junk. It's garbage. Now, I'm really sorry. Nature is too efficient to have 95% of our genetic makeup to be garbage. So geneticists today agree that DNA is the most powerful media storage device known in the universe. Even if we were to combine all supercomputers in the world, you know, we could not use, DNA would still be more powerful to store information. So I think that there is a message in that junk DNA somewhere, and it's only a matter of time to find it, and even, you know, who knows? Maybe it's already been found, and they're just waiting for the right time to release this. I mean, who knows?
Well, definitely, Francis Crick, one of the people who mapped the DNA helix structure and realized that DNA was a helix, he identified straight away, saying, well, this kind of structure is simply impossible to have been created by accident on planet Earth, simply from a longevity point of view. There had to be more time if it was created out of nothingness for this to happen. And he always believed and promoted the theory of panspermia, that somehow this had come from somewhere else, and not just on a human form, but literally DNA as in each bit of human life, each bit of life on planet Earth. So tying it back to kind of like the human component, us being this mixture of something Earth-like and something not Earth-like, what does mankind mean to you then? Are we, the Sitchin approach is that mankind was created pretty much as a slave, and that we are just here, and then the aliens went, and we're kind of like dancing around the Earth pretty much without a purpose, which is kind of different from all the religions. The religions say that we've been put here on Earth to fulfill a mission, to do good to the planet, to take care of it, which is also like where the Native American and so many other tribal traditions come from, that we are here for caretakers. So where do you stand? Where do you see the evidence going?
Yeah, I mean, personally, you know, I have a hard time subscribing to the slave theory, and we don't have enough time to, you know, delve into this. However, what I would like to mention is the fact that, you know, right now we're living in very interesting times regarding, you know, where mankind is headed, but also, you know, about the whole questions about genetics. Because right now there's basically two scientific camps. One, you have the evolutionary biologists who are studying everything following Darwin's, you know, evolution theory. And that's on the left side. And then all the way on the right side, you have these researchers who call themselves intelligent design researchers. And they suggest that, so the evolutionary biologists say, or maintain, that everything happened by pure coincidence and natural selection. And the ID people are saying, no, that can't be right, because there isn't enough time, and there, you know, something is there that happened. So it had to have been God, as in the God described in the Old Testament. Now here's the thing, that both camps are right and both camps are wrong, because the evolutionary biologists obviously are right, because the fossil record is there. There is no denying that, but anyone who has read The Origin of Species knows that Darwin himself, while being in love with his theory, did say, okay, I like this, but something doesn't make sense, because, you know, evolution should teach you go from in between stages or a stadium of development from point A to point B, from point B to point C, gradually. But the fossil record shows that we basically, not we, but many different species, went from point A to point D, from point D to point K, and so on and so forth. I mean, that is not ordinary evolution. So that means something happened in our past with our DNA. And so ID people, they are finding these hints in our DNA that something happened artificially, yet they say it was God, the creator of the universe, the force of creation and whatnot, which they ascribe to the God in the Bible. Well, I'm sorry, I've got news for you. The God described in the Old Testament was not God. It was a misunderstood flesh and blood extraterrestrials who visited Earth in the remote past with nuts and bolts spaceships, and they were completely aware that they would be, or that they would attain instant godlike status when they arrived here because of their advanced technology. Look, Arthur C. Clarke said it best. In 1961, he said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that sums up essentially the whole ancient astronaut theory. And it's truly amazing, You know, so what these two camps have to do, to return to the point, they have to meet in the middle, just like the Buddha said, it's the middle way.
Okay, so my question for you is this. I'm with you on a lot of this stuff. What concerns me and where I back off of this theory a little bit is I feel that sometimes this theory is taking away from our humanity. I feel that sometimes that this theory is taking away from our divinity and what we are capable of doing as humans, because I think there is real greatness within us. And I think to your point, it's like, yes, there is, but where does that come from? And I don't even know if that's an argument we need to have. But I think that there is a piece of me that is connected to this idea of divine intelligence and of something that is greater than us. Even the Vatican, even the Pope now says that it's okay to believe in alien life forms, yeah, which I think is really fascinating. It's not okay to believe that Jesus was married, but it's okay to believe that that aliens are out there, and that I believe that their statement was something to the effect of that is all then within the realm of God, that God is so great and God is so vast that we cannot limit what God might have created. And I think that's the church's perspective, which I think is interesting, and probably one of the few places where I might, you know, have harmony with the church. But I guess my question is, how do you reconcile that? Because I know you, and I know that you are a person of real heart and real spirit. So even though I hear some of your answers are very cerebral, I know that there's more going on in there. So how do you reconcile this idea of spirit and heart and human accomplishment and divine connection with some of the things that you're saying?
Well, you know, I have to leave now. No.
No.
But you see, yes, I truly do think that all of us are divine. Not just human beings, but also animals. And guess what? Also this table, also this computer. It's all part of the big divinity. And in my opinion, you see, look, when Einstein was asked, "Do you believe in God?" He asked the reporter, he asked the journalist, he said, "Well, that depends. We first have to discuss what your definition is of God, because your definition might be completely different than mine." And so I really think that should be, that still today, we should discuss that. What is your idea of God? Because to me, the idea of a personal God I don't see it. I just don't see it. However, let's say I take a piece of skin and I take a piece of stone and put them both under two electron microscopes, and I go deeper and deeper and deeper to their absolute core. And, you know, as you delve deeper, they're kind of different, but the very, very core, you cannot distinguish the two, because everything vibrates, everything wobbles, everything oscillates. It's all about harmonics. There's vast spaces in between these elements and particles and electrons. And so, which means that everything is made up of the same stuff. Like Carl Sagan said, we're made of star stuff, but that's not what I'm suggesting. It's that we're all one. We're all coming from that inner source, that universal force. So in my opinion, I think God is within everything. It's the universe. And if we look at the universe itself, which right now, you know, is expanding, and they say that ultimately it'll contract again, well, that is like the heart muscle. It goes on and off, on and off. So in my opinion, for example, I disagree with the Big Bang theory, that there never was a beginning, there never will be an end, because it is a mathematical fact, and not just a mathematical, but a scientific fact, that, you know, zero plus zero is zero. So if there was nothing, you cannot create something out of nothing unless there is this divine spark. But what if this divine spark, in my opinion, was always there? And if it is this contraction and expansion thing, like a heart muscle, you know, that because God transcends the Bible. God transcends any holy book, and creation and everything is way more magnificent than we can even imagine. And we're all part of it. And so many people, you know, they rely themselves on one single book and say that we're the crazy ones. If we don't believe in the Bible, that we're going to rot in hell. Now, I'm sorry, is that godlike? Is that, you know, is that pious to suggest to somebody else, well, if you don't believe in these pages, if you don't accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you will rot in hell. I mean, I want to go back in time and meet Jesus and ask him. And he will say, of course not. What are you, crazy? They're saying this about me in the future? What have I done?
I absolutely agree with you. And I'm fond of saying that if Jesus were here today, the people who are the most vocal about celebrating him are the ones who would slam the door in his face. Mm-hmm. And I wish we could go back in time and say this is what it's going to look like and get his reaction to that. But very well said, and amazing points. And as always, fantastic to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
This was The Spirit Revolution. You can visit our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. We are also on iTunes, and link on iTunes you can get from our website, or just type in The Spirit Revolution on iTunes and you will find us there. We will be back next week, but until then, from Kathleen and me,
the truth against the world. And then we'll put